From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
President Obama talks tough on Iran. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The president said today he's appalled and outraged and that he strongly condemns the killing of election protesters in Iran. But he denied that he escalated his criticism in response to Republicans on Capitol Hill. We'll hear more about today's news conference. Meantime, North Korea is vying for the world's attention. A ship reportedly loaded with banned weapons is being trailed by a U.S. destroyer. There are reports of plans to fire a missile toward Hawaii. What about the president's hope for constructive engagement? On Reporter's Notebook later on, the president defends the so-called public option for health care reform. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To The Point. North Korea has escalated tensions with the U.S. and the United Nations. We'll look at the provocations and the possible options for action. On Reporter's Notebook, would a so-called public option for health care reform put insurance companies out of business? We'll hear what President Obama has to say about that. First, this news update. He began his news conference today by responding to complaints about lukewarm support for election protesters in Iran.
The United States and the international community have been appalled and outraged by the threats, the beatings, and imprisonments of the last few days. I strongly condemn these unjust actions, and I join with the American people in mourning each and every innocent life that is lost.
After his prepared statement, the president was bombarded with questions.
Some Republicans on Capitol Hill, John McCain and Lindsey Graham, for example, have said that up to this point, your response on Iran has been timid and weak. Today, it sounded a lot stronger. It sounded like the kind of speech John McCain has been urging you to give, saying that those who stand up for justice are always on the right side of history, referring to an iron fist in Iran, deplore, appalled, outraged. Were you influenced at all by John McCain and Lindsey Graham accusing you of being timid and weak?
What do you think? Look, I think John McCain has genuine passion about many of these international issues. And I think that all of us share a belief that we want justice to prevail. But only I'm the president of the United States.
Ron Brownstein is political director of Atlantic Media, publishers of The Atlantic and National Journal magazines. He's also author of The Second Civil War, How Extreme Partisanship Has Paralyzed Washington and Polarized America. Ron Brownstein, always good to have you with us.
Hi, Warren.
The president kind of laughed that one off, but not others. He went into great detail and said several times that what really matters as far as Iran is concerned is what happens in Iran, not what happens in Washington. Has he, do you think, quieted the criticism?
Well, I think he, as always, was very comfortable with nuance and with carefully calibrating his remarks. We remember President Bush famously said to Joe Biden, at least according to Joe Biden, I don't do nuance. It sometimes seems that President Obama does almost nothing else. And I think he was effective in trying to move his response toward a somewhat sharper tone. But I thought that what was really unclear from this, and I think he struggled to answer, was whether his broader goal of engaging the Iranian government in more fruitful negotiations will still be plausible after this turmoil plays out. I think he was very vague and he was very unclear about where we go from here and whether it's possible to enter into the kind of negotiations that he once envisioned if, in fact, the regime perpetuates itself in this manner.
He really wasn't asked about that, though. He was asked again and again if he'd talk tough enough about what's happening what's happened over the past few days. Let me put it better that way. And defended what he has said already,
yeah,
saying he's really been consistent. And he said as recently as Saturday, he used the word appalled, and it was really more about language than
It was about language, although he was asked several times about consequences, and he was kind of reduced to formulations. One I wrote down was how the Iranians ultimately handle this. The Iranian government may, quote, end up coloring, unquote, how the international community responds to them. I think he was I think, look, I think throughout this entire thing, he has been looking for a kind of tightrope that would allow him to express the legitimate outrage that I'm sure he, like all Americans, feels, but would not put him in a position where he would seemingly preclude any kind of further contact or negotiation with the government that emerges if, in fact, those in power now keep power. And you know, there have been people have analyzed the criticism from the right as basically trying to put him in a lose-lose position. Either he seems weak and not standing up for American values, or he is forced to, in effect, take off the table his signature initiative here. And so I think he's trying to keep both doors open, and I think that was the tension that you have seen throughout this and again today in this press conference.
I suppose a lot of this the question of how long this will go on depends a lot on what happens in Iran. But at the moment, do you think that the president has managed to maintain his position, at least, without allowing himself to be pushed into that lose-lose situation?
Well, I think, you know, for the critics, obviously, for the conservative critics, probably not enough. I think more broadly in the foreign policy community, there's been more comfort with what he has been doing, although, again, concerned that perhaps he has erred too much on the side of nuance and not clearly affirming America, kind of traditional American values and our support for those who are out in the street demanding that their votes be counted fairly. So I think he kind of recalibrated that today. But look, overriding this all was the understanding that our leverage here is limited in terms of how this plays out.
Leverage is limited indeed. He was back to the responses to the immediate questions. He said the video of the young woman dying after having been shot when she just got out of her car was heartbreaking. He, it seems to me, handled that as any thinking, caring person would.
Yes. No. I don't think anybody watching even over the last few weeks would say, or last 10 days or so would say that the president lack sympathy for the belief of those in the streets that their votes must be counted. What he is trying to do is balance that natural instinct against the desire to maintain the opportunity to pursue this other policy that he would like to advance. And it's not clear that policy can survive this level of turmoil in Iran.
Back in a moment with Ron Brownstein. We'll talk also about what's happening with North Korea on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Norman Olney back with To the Point, still talking with Ron Brownstein, the political director of Atlantic Media, about the president and his comments about Iran today. He got a lot of questions on this. We heard one, which was a fairly hostile question about whether, in fact, he had sounded weak and timid and before, and whether he was responding to Republicans. He handled himself in a calm and self-assured way, but he sounded a little defensive in a couple of places. Here's one of them.
Track what I've been saying. Right after the election, I said that we had profound concerns about the nature of the election, but that it was not up to us to determine what the outcome was. As soon as violence broke out, in fact, in anticipation of potential violence, we were very clear in saying that violence was unacceptable, that that was not how governments operate with respect to their people.
Again, Ron Brownstein, back to you. What's the relationship between the president and the White House press corps at the moment?
Well, overall, I think that the general level of accessibility for the overall White House has been high, and the president certainly has done more regular news conferences, and he has been available for interviews from a wide variety of publications. In fact, some people argue that he may be getting himself overexposed. We have another ABC big day at the White House following the NBC big day at the White House. I think overall it is pretty good. But I think you're right. He felt there was a little bit of kind of a squaring of the shoulders on some of those questions today, particularly about whether he was responding to his critics. I think it is hard for him to make the case that the tone today was really identical with what it has been before, if that's what he's trying to argue. Certainly, if you look at the words, there's no shortage of admonition to the Iranian government to respect the will of their people. But I think clearly today was a different tone, whether he wants to acknowledge that or not.
Back to your earlier point about his effort to maintain his policy of opening up to Iran, if in fact there's a possibility, probably the toughest question he got came from via a reporter from somebody in Iran who said that if he ultimately recognized the election of Ahmadinejad, would that in fact delegitimize what the people are doing now on the street?
Right, and that shows you the difficulty that, this turn of events has placed him in. It was always going to be difficult to engage the Iranian government. Now, the further complication of questions about the legitimacy, enormous questions about the legitimacy of this government, lingering in the air, if in fact it ends the way that it now appears today.
Ron Brownstein, again, the political director of Atlantic Media. Always good to talk with you, and thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Warren.
Steve Clemens is a senior fellow and director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation. He's publisher of the political blog, thewashingtonnote.com. Steve Clemens, good to have you on our program.
Great to be with you. How is it out there, Warren?
It's very nice in Southern California at the moment. How is it in Washington?
It's very nice out here, too.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Despite all the turmoil in the world.
Yeah, there certainly is a lot of turmoil, and a lot of turmoil for this president. And we've talked, Ron Brownstein just talked about how the president wants to maintain this policy of engagement with Iran. He didn't get any questions at all about what's happening right now in the Pacific Ocean with regard to North Korea, with a ship that reportedly has
John McCain.
Yeah, the ship called the John McCain is following a North Korean a ship that allegedly has banned arms aboard. And there's talk coming from the Japanese media that there may be a missile fired, test missile fired, in the direction of Hawaii. And the question there, of course, is whether the president then what he has to do now, first of all, and secondly, can he maintain any hope of negotiating with North Korea over its nuclear program?
Well, there are various schools of thought. I think the USS John McCain is out there steaming. There have been concerns that we've sort of created the Security Council resolution support for what we're doing. The Chinese have said we can't do anything in their waters, so we're waiting for the ship, which may already be in international waters, but that's where a boarding would happen if it did. And it would be the first sort of harder-edged move that we had taken in North Korea after all of its antics, after the nuclear test, after the various missile launches aimed really towards Japan. And in this particular case, you've got a complication. China's very influential, but has different interests that we do. They want stability no matter what the cost, which means China's willing to appease an awful lot of bad behavior. And there are many folks who think that there is a leadership crisis going on in North Korea, and tied to that leadership crisis is some appetite for demonstrating the strength and resolve of the state, and an incredible amount of irresponsible pinpricks of the United States trying to get attention and potentially to get us back to a negotiating table so that they can extract resources from the United States and from the West in general. And, I think that Obama has to be very careful. To some degree, I think he has made a mistake by not getting an assistant secretary of state like Chris Hill used to be back and deployed there. We have Kirk Campbell, who was announced by the president at the time, but he's been languishing forever, unconfirmed. And we don't have anyone else but Steve Bosworth. Steve's a great guy, but he's been sort of doing this part-time with North Korea. And we need, greater attention. Attention is cheap to give, and we ought to give that. It's better than having a war on the Korean Peninsula. But right now, we're seeing a clear escalation in rhetoric and posture, including by the United States right now. And at one of these points, you may actually end up in a hot conflict. But we can't just, in my view, appease all of these issues by North Korea. And they themselves continue to push more and more the less we react.
Maybe because Kurt Campbell hasn't been confirmed and it has seemed to be a low priority, that's the reason there was no question about it at the news conference today, which went on for an hour. And the president was asked about his smoking habits. I was rather surprised he didn't get a question on this subject.
I am too. I think it's a big mistake. This is really important for you to highlight, because there's a lot of stuff going around in the world. And while the drama in Iran is important, what you see is a lot of the world kind of testing Obama. And what we see in North Korea is exactly what Joe Biden said would happen, is that this administration would be tested. It has been tested repeatedly. And I think, you know, we've got to be able to play ball in a number of courts at the same time.
One question. You said there was a possibility of a boarding in international waters. Doesn't the UN resolution say that no boarding can occur? This would be to inspect and see what the cargo is, unless there is consent from the country that owns the ship?
That is a technical detail about which I'm not aware, so you may be more fully informed there. My understanding, as I understood it, of the resolution, when it came, is it would create a it would seem fairly ridiculous and toothless to have a resolution that only required, you know, that required agreement of the country that was being boarded. So you may be right, and if that's the case, then that means that we've passed another toothless resolution in the Security Council. But my understanding is that the issues with China more recently is that China was objecting to boarding a vessel in their waters, and thus this was not done. And so the USS John S. McCain has been trailing this ship and waiting. And the Japanese, who have sunk North Korean submarines in the past and have told North Korean ships in their entirety to stay out of Japanese waters for the time being, but no one knows what they will do if there is a penetration of Japanese waters. But it's a very, very tense arena of the world right now.
We'll pursue this issue later in our program, but back to your principal point that it's time for the Obama administration, I think you're saying, to pay more public attention to this as the rhetoric escalates, but the options look pretty limited.
Well, they are. I mean, but I think the one rule, I mean, it'd be interesting to hear some of your other speakers. North Korea, you know, it's sort of a relationship that moves in cycles. And to sort of think that you're just going to straight line out either good relations with North Korea or bad. I mean, oftentimes if you see lots of progress, and I think overall the progress that Christopher Hill made during the Bush administration, which Al Kamen in the Washington Post today called a flop, I don't. I think it delayed time, bought time, helped move us forward, helped get a destruction of a nuclear facility, began to sort of help sort out what was going on in this very opaque, weird kingdom there. And to some degree, that helped move us along. Now, with a period of inattention, we see naughty behavior, very provocative behavior, combined with a leadership crisis in North Korea. And so you can push the wrong buttons and overreact. But my friendly criticism of Barack Obama has been an underattention that needs to be resolved. And this country seems to need to be engaged. Now, if we have a game plan that we want to engage in regime change, I don't usually support those sort of things. Well, get it. But right now, we seem to have an absence of strategy and an absence of a game plan and a way forward. And we can't get engaged in sort of a tit-for-tat escalation on that peninsula without having some idea where we want to take the relationship. And that's been China's deepest criticism of us, by the way. I think China would love to be more supportive of, but they found an absence of strategy in their U.S. interlocutors on this as well.
Well, Steve Clements, it's always good to talk with you, and thanks for taking the time.
Thank you, Warren.
Senior Fellow, Director of the American Strategy Program at the New America Foundation and the publisher of the political blog, thewashingtonnote.com. David Kong is Professor of International Relations and Business and Director of the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California. And Professor, thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, my pleasure.
Can you clear up this question of what the UN resolution says about the possibility of boarding or trying to interdict shipments by North Korea?
Well, again, I'm not a lawyer per se, but my understanding was that they were not going to board without approval or consent of the North Koreans.
Yeah, that's
and
what
so
I thought.
They would. Yeah, they would shadow and wait until they got to a port, and then the port authorities would supposedly have more ability to actually board the ship or inspect.
Unless they sail into a port in a country that doesn't cooperate with the United Nations, which is entirely possible because the ship appears to be headed for Myanmar.
Yes, and so the hope is, or the I guess the question is, will they have to stop for fuel in, say, Singapore or something, or can they get all the way to Myanmar?
And Singapore has said if it stops there, they will proceed according to what the UN wants, which apparently would be a refusal to provide fuel or help the ship in any way unless it was allowed to be inspected by international authorities. In any case, how serious is this situation, do you think? Steve Clemens just mentioned the possibility of war on the Korean peninsula. Are we anywhere close to that?
I would say that remains a very small possibility. The danger, of course, as Steve pointed out, is that without realizing it, we go tit for tat and we keep ramping up the pressure. Right now, though, I think both North Korea and the United States and everybody is very aware that starting an actual hot shooting war would be incredibly destructive for everybody involved. And so while there could be some sporadic, gunfire in the West Sea or something, I think right now we're still a ways away from actually worrying about a real war.
Well, now, in addition to the ship that we've talked about with, again, allegedly banned cargo, I think it's small arms, it's not nuclear weapons or anything of that kind. What about this threat to fire or test a missile? North Korea has told ships to stay out of waters east of North Korea starting on Thursday, I believe, for 16 days. And the Japanese press has said that there may be a missile tested in the direction of Hawaii. Steve Clemens again said it's really Japan that's most threatened by the missiles. But what about that, and what would an appropriate reaction be from the United States?
Well, I mean, this is the problem that the U.S. has faced for quite a while, but certainly the Obama administration, which is the North Koreans are actually fairly consistent, which is they meet pressure with pressure of their own. And in conversations with American administration officials before the U.N. resolution got passed a couple weeks ago, everybody is basically clear that passing the resolution was going to provoke a response from North Korea. Everybody expects it's going to be some kind of a missile launch. So the real question is, what do you do after that? And there, it's not so clear, because if we continue to ratchet up and the North Koreans continue to ratchet up, eventually you face the question of, okay, how much are we going to escalate? And nobody really wants to go there. So I think that the problem for the Obama administration is some kind of response is very important, because the North Koreans have been sort of exceedingly provocative in the last couple months. So they couldn't just sit by without opening themselves up to real criticism of being soft. At the same time, you go too far and you end up in a situation that nobody wants to be in. And they're in a very difficult position.
The Secretary of Defense has talked about moving surface-to-air missile defenses of some kind into Hawaii. The North Koreans don't have the capacity to actually hit Hawaii, do they?
No. And that's one thing that we sort of tend to overlook. Both of the previous long-range missile tests failed. And most analysts think it's 5 to 10 years before they would be able to have the capacity to actually hit Hawaii or Alaska. So, and one reason they like the test is, every failed test, they learn something and they get a little closer to it. Their medium and short-range missiles, we know that they can hit all of South Korea and parts of Japan, but they certainly can't hit Hawaii right now.
So no immediate concern then about an attack, but a lot of concern about the provocation and about what the ultimate consequences might be, particularly for nuclear development. We'll talk about that and other factors in a moment as we continue this conversation after we take a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, the president defends the public option for health care reform. We'll hear how that went, and we'll come back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about something that somewhat unaccountably didn't come up at the president's news conference today, and that is the provocative actions of North Korea very prominently and publicly sailing a ship toward Myanmar with what is reportedly a banned cargo and suggesting that it might test another missile, this time in the direction of Hawaii. David Kong is a professor of international relations and business and director of the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California. We've been talking with him, and he is still with us. Chaebong Ham is a North Korea expert at the RAND Corporation. And Chaebong Ham, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Do you agree with Steve Clemens that at the moment there's a kind of lack of policy and focus on the part of the Obama administration?
Oh, yes, I clearly do, and there's really no doubt. But at the same time, I think what we need to understand is why North Korea is doing this, and I think there of course, it's a reaction to American inattention. But also, there's another important factor, I think, which that most of us are missing, which is that I think North Korea is currently undergoing a rather fundamental policy shift of their own, and which is causing a lot of this. It used to be, we need to start with basics. With any government or any regime, national security, and in North Korea's case, regime survival is their topmost priority. And I think until very recently, until perhaps year ago even, there was a sense in which North Korea said that, look, you know, we can give up our nuclear weapons if in exchange we get normalization of relations with the United States, investment, aid and trade, etc. That was the assumption. That was the whole deal behind the six-party talks process that went on. But then I think as of end of last year, there's a fundamental shift here going on, which is that North Korea has, I think, basically decided, look, they're not going to give up their nuclear weapons, that they want to be recognized now as a de facto nuclear power, which will give them, of course, enhanced bargaining chip. And at the same time, this really goes hand in hand with their domestic situation, which you have alluded to earlier, you know, succession and otherwise. But I think more broadly, even domestically, you know, North Korea has been, for the past 10 years, again, because of the very generous engagement policy from South Korea, et cetera, they were attempting, at least partially, to give a go at a reform policy. But I think, you know, they've decided now that has been a very dangerous experiment. There was too much exposure to the outside world, perhaps. And so there's a retrenchment going on politically and economically. And lastly, you know, the missile test, the nuclear test, all of that really proves to the people, North Korean people, that now they have really arrived. You know, given all of their sacrifices, the hardship, the famine, etc., that they've been going through for the past 10 years because of all the imperialist pressure, sanctions, etc., we've overcome this now, and we're a powerful nation with all these weapons of mass destruction. So that gives them a great sense of pride, and it gives them a sense of togetherness, unity, which, of course, will probably contribute to stability and for the succession that is currently taking place.
Elaborate a bit on the succession. This coming just a few years before 2012, which would be the 100th anniversary of the birth of Kim Il-sung, who was the founder of North Korea, father of the current leader. And the current leader, as I understand it, wants to pass leadership on to his son.
Exactly. That's apparently what's going on. The latest news coming out of South Korea, in the North Korea People's Daily column, which is one of the clearest indications of where North Korea is going, there are these references to the bloodline, the revolutionary bloodline of Kim Il-sung, and which most of the analysts are taking is a clear reference to now this upcoming third dynastic succession to the grandson.
Let me ask you this. To the outside world, much of what goes on or what we think goes on in North Korea seems very bizarre and very difficult to understand. The paranoia, for example, and the idea that the United States and South Korea are planning a nuclear attack on North Korea, which has been said recently. To what extent do the North Korean people, do you think, really believe what they're being told?
Oh, I think it's two things. It's an incredibly isolated country. There's very little access to information from the outside world, than for a very select elite. And it's really important to remember the foundation upon which North Korea was built, which is this great siege mentality that something that all Koreans, I guess, share, which is that Korea is this small shrimp amid big whales, that it's always been colonized, it's been victimized by these great powers. And North Korea, most clearly during the Japanese occupation, but then also during the Korean War, was the enemy of the United States and suffered greatly in that war in terms of destruction. The other part, so there is that whole idea that we need to fend for ourselves, that we need to stick with our great leaders who are able to fend off these great big guys, bad guys surrounding us. That part of that narrative, that hyper-nationalist and siege mentality narrative has been built into the system right from the beginning. So it's ironic in a sense that I get the sense that, look, if the more sanctions are imposed, the more threats that are coming from the outside world, it sort of feeds into the North Korea's propaganda. And it actually just basically strengthened the regime because they can tell the people, look, this is exactly what we've been telling the people. So, you know, that's another part of the difficulty in dealing with North Korea.
Again, Chai Bong Ham is a North Korea expert at the RAND Corporation. Jim Walsh is an expert in international security. He's a research associate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And Jim Walsh, good to have you on our show.
Good to be with you, Warren.
To what extent do you think the diplomacy of North Korea is motivated by what we have just heard, the idea that the country is threatened by the outside? And what does that mean, then, when it's asserted that we ought to have more sanctions and more threats if they're liable to be counterproductive?
Well, I think it is liable to be counterproductive, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in what we've heard from Steve and David and Chai Bong. But I would say there's also some conceptual confusion, because what we're getting is a picture of North Korea that is both engaged in bargaining behavior, brinksmanship, the good old North Korea we've all known and loved over the last decade and a half. Oh, and there's this other thing called the succession crisis, and that should be added in as a variable too. I tend to view it differently in saying that this is, and of course we have to say we don't know. You know, a little humility when it comes to North Korea is always a good thing. But if I'm guessing, I'm saying that it's the succession crisis that is paramount and primary. If before, when North Korea was driven by bargaining behavior, that's a sort of stance where what you're concerned about is the outside world. You're bargaining with the outside world, or you're keeping your nuclear weapons if you're of a neocon persuasion because of the outside world. But this succession has North Korea focused internally, and I don't think it really matters what the outside world does. Sanctions, no sanctions, quote, paying attention, not paying attention. This is driven by internal dynamics that they are chained to, regardless of what the outside world does. And so when you have a country, and a lot of countries go through this, if someone's assassinated and there's a leadership change or something's going on, countries tend to retract from the outside world. They tend to puff themselves up to engage in displays of strength, both to scare adversaries who might take advantage, in their mind, take advantage of them during a period of uncertainty and weakness, and to send a signal to the domestic population, as Chai Bong wisely says. So, I'm real doubtful that it's a good idea to squeeze a cracked egg. It seems to me that if we board a ship, the worst of all possible ideas in my mind, we're going to get a crisis escalation that puts countries on a path to a conflict that no one wants. So I think, by contrast, the president has handled it fairly well. I'm sure he's focused on it. He tried to send an envoy early on. He was rebuffed. And so right now, the president, I think, is basically focused not on trying to force North Korea to change as much as to reassure Japan and our allies. And at this point, I think that's pretty much all he can do until this other stuff settles itself out.
Reassure Japan and South Korea. We seem to have a closer relationship with South Korea than almost ever before.
Yeah, well, part of that is the new president in South Korea and a change, a more conservative president, a change in tone and a change in policy. But I think, in general, at the end of the day, it's still Japan and the Japanese domestic opinion that most freaks out any time you have a missile launch or a nuclear explosion, which is understandable. But that's sort of the third rail in for us right now. And we're attentive to saying to Japan, rightly, I think, we've got your back. Don't worry. We're here for you. And so the president is walking a very fine line where he has to reassure the allies, but not in such an aggressive manner that it further complicates the situation with North Korea and making it even more dangerous than it currently is.
When you talk about a conflict that nobody wants, certainly China does not want to see a conflict on the Korean Peninsula. China has said that it doesn't want to see nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula. The United States has removed its nuclear weapons from there. North Korea now is building its up. What about China, and how important is China to diplomacy?
Yeah, I thought Steve earlier was a little harsh calling them appeasers. I think China is critical to this. I mean, of course, they're the host of the six-party talks. They don't want a problem stepchild, nuclear stepchild, on their border, but they don't want a collapse in Korea either. But, you know, at the end of the day, what Americans should understand is the process of negotiation or diplomatic resolution to this only goes forward if there is a strong relationship between China and North Korea. We want China to have a good relationship with North Korea, because if that isn't there, North Korea isn't going to have the confidence to enter into a process where it gives up its nuclear weapons. Essentially, China is, China is supposed to be watching North Korea's back, just as we watch out for Japan. But as Chai Mong rightly pointed out, you know, the North Koreans don't trust the Chinese. I mean, it's a love-hate relationship. They're brothers in revolution, but China is a great power. The U.S. is a great power. North Korea sees itself as a mouse surrounded by elephants, and it worries that the U.S. and China are going to cut a deal and leave them hanging out to dry. So we have to be careful about what we say China ought to be doing, because we need the China-Korean relationship to be a healthy one if we're going to get out of this thing. And some people point to the fact, I don't think it's central, but it's at least worth taking note, that China originally said after the first space launch, yes, North Korea has the right to a civilian space launch, but then it signed on to that UN president statement that criticized it. My guess is that meant unhappy relations between Beijing and Pyongyang, and things aren't quite right yet.
Jim Walsh, again, a research associate, expert in international security at MIT. Pardon me. Chai Bong Ham, back to you, a North Korea expert at the RAND Corporation. Jim Walsh just suggested that there's no way that North Korea is going to give up its nuclear establishment if it doesn't have a close relationship with China. Do you think there is a possibility that it'll give up its nuclear development?
Well, I think that's the million-dollar question here. But I think just to reinforce what Jim just said about China, I think it's clear that the relationship between North Korea and China is not the close client-patron relationship that we keep imagining that it is. In fact, I think, you know, there's also a sense in which North Korea is trying to send a message to China too, clearly, and I don't think the Chinese are missing this, which is that there's a lot of debate within China now as to how to change perhaps their policy towards North Korea, perhaps adopting a harsher line. But I think the real point, as far as the North Koreans are concerned, is that, look, South Korea has this treaty, this defense treaty with the United States, which has been constantly reinforced, of course, as we know, most recently with during the summit meeting between Presidents Obama and Lee, extended nuclear deterrent, et cetera, whereas Chinese commitment to the defense of North Korea in the case of war is anything but very clear, and it has remained very murky. So North Korea feels rather abandoned, and they feel rather threatened. As Jim just said, you know, they are, I think, thinking that there is a possibility that U.S. and China might actually cut a deal.
Still with us, David Kong, professor of international relations and business, director of the Korean Studies Institute at the University of Southern California. What do you think about the relationship between North Korea and China, and the way that influences the possibility of North Korea giving up its nuclear program?
Well, I think everybody's had really good points. I like Jim's particularly because we tend to think that China is somehow going to always take our side. And we really have to see what China's worried about. And they're, you know, the U.S. in particular is worried about North Korean strength and its nuclear weapons. And as we talked about before, they can't even hit us, but we're worried that they're going to export them to people who will use them against us. China is much more concerned with North Korean weakness and the cost and the chaos that'll come from some kind of collapse or rapid regime change. And to that extent, we really do want China to be engaged in this process and to have a good relationship with North Korea. I think the North Koreans don't trust the Chinese at all. And as Jaebong pointed out, the real big question is, would North Korea ever find it in its own interest to give up its nuclear weapons? And one thing that we tend to overlook, because we sort of poo-poo the idea that we would ever attack North Korea, but we certainly do not like North Korea the way that it is. We refuse to recognize their status. You know, we don't have normal relations. I'm not saying we should, but North Korea certainly sees a policy of the United States that really wants it to change and fundamentally doesn't like it. And that's the real conundrum, is can we live with a North Korea, even if they don't have nuclear weapons? I think most Americans would say we still shouldn't really like them very much. And that's one of the problems that we face, is how to deal with a country that we really don't like who they are.
Just quickly explain why it is that China is so afraid of a weak nuclear North Korea, North Korea, or fearful that the government might collapse. How would that affect China?
Well, in a couple very direct ways. I mean, the first one is refugees. If there's a collapse in North Korea, the refugees are going to two countries. They're going to go to China or South Korea. And we're talking hundreds of thousands of them could be flooding over the border. This is not something that China wants. More unemployed people who don't speak Chinese. There's ethnic implications for domestic Chinese politics because there's a sizable ethnic Korean population in northeast China. So there's a lot of domestic repercussions if North Korea collapses. Also, what happens is there will be a military in North Korea that probably won't voluntarily disarm, and you could see shooting. The Chinese would be involved in that. And, of course, the mess just in terms of cleaning up afterwards with loose nukes and how much money it would cost. So they're much more cautious about pushing hard on the North Korean regime than the United States, which, frankly, we're not going to see any of those costs if North Korea collapses. It's not going to affect us very directly at all.
So, Chaebong Kam, final question to you at the RAND Corporation. Do we just let this continue then rather than responding strongly, or do we try to formulate a response that is strong but not threatening enough to cause further escalation?
I think we have already, with the United Nations resolution and the constant, very close consultation with the allies, and the ongoing consultations, cooperation with China, we have created a very solid international response roundly, unanimously condemning North Korean actions. So at this point, I think we need to be patient. I think last thing we want to do is overreact. This has been brought up, this point has been brought up by many already, and I just wanted to reinforce that. So the threat perception, given what has happened, is very high. I understand very provocative things being said, Hawaii being targeted, etc. But really, very interesting point that we forget is how muted the reaction of the South Korean public is to all of this. And you have to remember, if there's anybody who should feel the most threatened by all of this, is South Korea, and they've been very muted, and because for them it's part of an ongoing series of threats that has been going on for past 50 years. So if you take it within that context, I think you can be more patient and avoid overreacting.
A million-man army right over the border, and enough conventional weapons pointed at Seoul, the capital city of South Korea, to take it out in very short order. Thank you all very much for being with us. Chaebong Kam, a North Korea expert at the RAND Corporation, David Kong at the University of Southern California, Jim Walsh at MIT. Thanks again for all of you for being with us today. Healthcare reform has been stalled in Congress, in part because of what's called the public option to private insurance. Today, the president responded to criticisms from the insurance industry, as we'll hear in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Warren Olney back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. The president's healthcare reform plan calls for a public option to private insurance. And today, two major insurance conglomerates claimed it would put them out of business. Here's part of the president's response.
If private insurers say that the marketplace provides the best quality health care, if they tell us that they're offering a good deal, then why is it that the government, which they say can't run anything, suddenly is going to drive them out of business? That's not logical.
President Obama at his news conference today. Noam Levy is congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times, specializes in health care. And Noam, good to have you back on our program.
Oh, my pleasure, Warren.
What is it that, or I guess I should say, what's the audience that the Congress, that the president is addressing here? It's really the Congress, isn't it, including Democrats?
Well, I think it is the Congress. It's also the American public. The president and the administration are sensitive to the fact that you mentioned in the lead up, which is that as this healthcare debate started on Capitol Hill, it's been slow going. It's been tough going, and there have been no shortage of questions already about whether things are behind where they ought to be and is the whole effort doomed. So I think the president is trying to steady his troops both in Washington and around the country.
And the polls are interesting, showing that on the one hand, people want to see change in the healthcare system, but on the other hand, most of them say they like their insurance plans.
That's right. There's a little bit of the phenomenon that we see with members of Congress in public schools, in the sense that people say they like their member of Congress even though they want to throw all the bums out. And there's a little bit of that, although the administration and congressional Democrats are playing on a little bit of fear that they see in public opinion that people will lose their health insurance. Obviously, most Americans have insurance. Many of them are satisfied with their coverage. But with the economic downturn, with so many people losing their coverage, I think they believe that there's a sensitivity there among a lot of Americans, fear that they may lose that. And one of the things the president actually talked about explicitly today was, if we do nothing, those of you who are satisfied with what you have, you may not have it anymore. And as he tried to make the case for the urgency of acting.
Cost of insurance are rising faster than wages by a long a shot. Well, what about what we just heard, what the president poses then? Why is it that the government, which the insurance companies say can't run anything, suddenly is going to drive the insurance companies out of business if, in fact, they're offering the great product they say they are? How do they respond to that?
Well, they argue that there is essentially no way for the federal government to design a program that could compete on a level playing field with private insurers. They allege that because the government has huge market power, because the government controls Medicare and therefore could exert a lot of influence on providers and control the insurance marketplace, that they'll be able to offer artificially low prices, and that people may simply flee. And of course, the natural implication for that, which the broader Republican argument against healthcare is, that if enough people flee to government healthcare, at the end of the day, you have only government healthcare, which is fewer options rather than more, which is what the president is obviously arguing for.
And, of course, they're also complaining that if the government's operation is based on artificially low prices, that's going to come out of taxpayers, because we'll have to provide the subsidies. But the president said today that his primary goal with health care reform is to keep the cost down. That's even number one ahead of number two, which is to provide insurance for everybody.
Well, the president and his Democratic allies are sensitive to the fact that most people do have insurance in this country, and that most people's main concern is the fact that their premiums are rising higher, that when they go to the doctor, they're finding that they're getting stuck with co-pays and various other responsibilities that they're having trouble understanding. And so I think they understand if they want to appeal to the broadest sector of the country, they need to talk about something that really hits everybody where it counts, which is in the pocketbook.
The White House strategy here has been to try to let Congress come up with legislation after setting broad goals, the idea to give them a buyout. Is this the strongest language that the president has used? Is he sort of being flushed out here on this public option?
It is among the strongest. He's been ratcheting up his rhetoric in recent weeks on the public option. You may recall that he traveled to Green Bay 2 weeks ago to hold a town hall meeting about health care. He's doing another one of those tomorrow at the White House. He went to Chicago last week and talked to the AMA, in which he gave quite a spirited defense of both the public plan and as well as his broader health care agenda. So he is stepping it up. But I did think it was notable that today he also refused to sort of draw a line in the sand on creating a government option. He was asked twice whether he would sign a bill that didn't have a new government insurance program, and he said he would he didn't want to make an ultimatum like that, which suggests that that sort of pragmatic approach, the non-ideological approach that he's tried to make his hallmark in dealing with healthcare issues remains his strategy. So there's a lot of wheeling and dealing going on right now on Capitol Hill, a lot of talk about how do you structure a new government program in a way that doesn't drive private insurers out of business, that still can get the necessary votes on Capitol Hill. And I think the president is sensitive to the fact that there's quite a bit more negotiation that has to go on here.
Okay. And just quickly, again, the Congressional Budget Office, of course, has said that the president's plan would cost $1.6 trillion. Got a lot of people excited. And again, the president responded today that his principal goal is to lower costs, not increase them. So there's an awful lot of passionate rhetoric, as well as a lot of frightening statistics being bandied about as this debate goes on. Noam Levy, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Congressional reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Today's program produced by Sonia Geis, with Katie Cooper and Gary Scott, our technical directors Mike Newport, managing producers Cameron Radziner. You can email us or share your thoughts on our comment page. That's at kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW's Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.